welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 11 continues. Arlene, have you got a moment to sit down? Arlene turned in a flash. No, Eliza, I don't have a moment to sit down. I know what you want to talk about, same as the chief of police, same as the doctor. You want me to complain against my own husband. Well, if you had a husband yourself, you'd know better. Now the woman got out the door and shut it behind her. 3 years of parish work had toughened up Eliza to being a single person in a culture where any single woman over 21 had less cachet than even a battered wife like Arlene. She sat on, turning her glance out the gorgeous, soldered pane casement. There was the little glade. There was the salt lick. Snow was falling on it. Beyond the glade school, the evergreen forest, dying off a half mile on its south edge each year, a gloomy truth you took in only if you were looking for it. She finally stalked into the nave to change the hymn boards in the usual way. Then she caught sight of Vern, a man who helped his father run the town bakery. She had never actually gone out with him because they met regularly enough at one of the parish family's nearly weekly buffet suppers. As the 14 or 16, sometimes even 20, educated Episcopalians went back and forth, filling their plates with salmon and cilantro and refilling their glasses, they got to know one another. They were the intellectuals scattered around the area. They made up the leadership of St. Frissy Church. They were really like small animals warming themselves at the same hearth. Vern swung up the walk toward her with a huge smile. He was a man with perfect male beauty. Despite it, he managed not to look vacant. His eyes were prematurely wrinkled a little. From the first, he moved her. From the first, she watched him while appearing, as she must, not to be looking. Even though she was clergy, Eliza was gradually eased into the loop of town gossip. She found that Vern Denham was an educated man who now worked in the town's one bakery. The gossip was that he had just left some high-end corporate job in Midtown St. Paul for ethical reasons. He strode up the paved stones toward her. She said to herself, "I knew he would come. I knew he would, sooner or later." And so he had. His face blazed, too, with happiness. Unmistakably, to him she said, "You hiked down here all the way from your place? You probably feel so fit, I bet you don't want to come in any stuffy old rectory. Shall we stand around outside in the snow instead?" He laughed again. They were at the door. "No, no," he cried. "What I've got to say is too big. We have to go in." She pitched ahead of him like a harbor tug, bringing a huge liner into its slip. "What a stunner of a view," Vern said, going fast to the sitting room window. "This is why we all want to live up here, isn't it? It's the wild forest." He stood there silently. Her heart was full, but also languorous. Let him take his time. This moment in her life would never come for them again. She chose not to go up to the window and stand beside him. Then he turned around. Since the snow light outdoors was now behind him, she couldn't see his face so well, but she felt joy steeping in. At last he said, "Well, this isn't really so much church business. I came on as a personal thing." Inside herself, she felt somber and blessed. "I'm going to get married, Eliza, married. And so I've come to find out what needs to happen when an old, fallen-away Lutheran like me wants to get married to a dyed-in-the-wool Episcopalian. You will want to instruct us, won't you?" He gave a tender, furry laugh with a little thrum to it. Deep in the engine room of her mind, Eliza gathered all the discipline and skills she had. She gave Vern what she hoped looked like a beatific smile. He laughed again, like chiming. "Aren't you even going to ask me who I'm marrying?" "Of course I am, of course. Who are you marrying?" "Imogene," he cried. "Imogene Tenebrae. I thought you might guess, since you see us together so much at the Tenebrae's, those weekend things of her parents." Eliza got herself across the room perfectly okay. She shook his hand. "Congratulations, Vern," she said. She felt sublime, like someone who has just been shot, but even mortally wounded, can pull off one more good thing. She took his shoulders and gave him a hug. He had any number of questions to ask about instructions, baptism prayers. His were Lutheran. If he could find them at all, did she mind? Confirmation credentials? What must he do? She must be wondering, he exclaimed, why he had not brought Emma Jane. But she had an appointment that day. He wanted to explain every detail. Eliza did everything she had to do. She shredded a mental picture of herself holding a first child of Vern's and Emma Jean's for its baptism, and then a second child, perhaps a third even. She stopped herself. She told herself, you need only last another minute. Surely Vern was ready to get up and go now. Some more minutes passed. She told herself, perhaps he is just going now. Long before he left, she told herself, maybe he really is done now. At last he had leapt toward her. His hug struck her the way Andor's grapple and close on a log. A week earlier, she had telephoned down to Minneapolis to her old seminary pal. Bill said, come down, Eliza. Evening prayer at 6:30. Then come back to the house and Molly and I will give you supper. He used to roll his eyes up at all the unbelievable idiocies of their seminary life. Oh, and she had done it, too. She had. Here was the bishop on the hour. Eliza tried for jauntiness with herself. The bishop remained in his car for a moment. He seemed to be looking at something, leant up against the steering wheel, probably his notes or schedule for the rest of the day's travel. It probably said, fire Eliza at 11 a.m. at St. Fursey's. See so-and-so at St. Thomas Hibbing. See so-and-so at St. Helen's Ely. Eliza wondered how much time was allotted to her. Several of her classmates at Seabury Western did not believe the most central tenets of Christian doctrine. Eliza knew that, but she didn't think there was safety in numbers. This bishop, who was two generations older than she, wouldn't be an unbeliever. He was not going to be sympathetic. He came up the walk with his ascetic forehead and the decided mouth. Eliza had forgotten how that face gave off competence. Intelligence, of course, but especially competence. And especially now, how naturally authoritative the man looked. She tried to jeer to herself in the old way. Competent, right. What's so holy about competence? But her sodden heart wouldn't jeer. Eliza bounded away from the window to open the door. She put out her hand quickly. It's awfully good to see you, Bishop, she said. Hello, Eliza, hello, hello, he cried. They grasped hands, then hugged. The bishop looked around as comfortable as an old dog. I always forget how beautiful this place is, he said. Certainly this has got to be one of the prettiest churches and rectories in the diocese. Each time I come, those huge old oaks look even taller. Come in, Bishop. Let's just stand here a minute, he said. I want to look around for a second. The bishop was in his 70s. He had retired from a large parish in New Hampshire, where word was everyone loved him. He had come to serve Minnesota as bishop at about the time Eliza was installed as rector at St. Fursey. Most bishops at most installations gave peaceable sermons about how we are all learning this business of being Christian together, even ordained people. The usual message seeming to say, everyone is equal, the usual slush that had regularly made Bill Place and Eliza roll their eyes. This new bishop of Minnesota did not give that pitch. He had told them about St. Cyprian. Cyprian had been bishop in Carthage at the time of the Diocletian abuses. When the plague came, Cyprian cleared out of town because, sensibly enough, as his followers told him, they were going to need him, their spiritual leader, alive to fight another day. Cyprian wrote spirited, filled letters to those Christians remaining in Carthage. The Christians who stayed behind cared for the sick first, then sickened themselves, then mostly died. The second time the plague came around, Cyprian stayed in town. He helped with the stricken, improved the system for removal of the dead, organized transport for survivors. The Romans renewed their persecutions. This time they executed Cyprian. Cyprian had learned to be brave, although as usual, the bishop had said, one must realize that bravery is much less practical than cowardice. In fact, this bishop had said, Christianity had little to do with practicality and much to do with courage. Christianity was uniformly impractical. The bishop now said, let's cross over into the church. Quickly and naturally, like a habitué tipping a doorman, the bishop jammed a bill into the poor box slot. He gave only a brief glance at the little high table piled with regular tracts showing animals strapped down to be tortured by surgical students or by chemists working for perfume companies and the like. Eliza put out a hand by way of steering and welcoming the bishop into her office just off the hall. "No, no," cried the old man. "Let's go sit in the back of the nave." He swung open one of the double doors himself and led the way in, as if he, not Eliza, ran the place. Eliza felt two things. She had just lost authority, although it was officially still her church, and she felt comforted. Maybe it wouldn't take very long. He would fire her and leave. "Do you want the lights on, Bishop?" she said. He waved a wrist. He said, "Don't bother," and crossed himself, spent a moment in silence, then finally took a seat in the back pew, leaving space for Eliza to join him. The entire nave was lighted only by the snowfall outside. The bishop turned sideways to half-face Eliza. "All right, your letter said you were having a crisis of faith. Tell me about it." Eliza was trained in the drill of counseling with downhearted parishioners. She supposed the bishop was about to put these theologian's skills into practice with her. He would ask some questions, let Eliza explain her feelings, and then do whatever he might do in his role as boss. Warn Eliza, or advise her, or command her to resign. First, though, right now, he would give Eliza the requisite eye contact, keep his own face interested but neutral. None of that happened. The old man said, "First, in your letter you use that phrase, crisis of faith. What in hell does that phrase actually mean?" Eliza muttered that she did not believe in God. The bishop comfortably crossed his legs and laid both hands over his top knee. He simply began to talk. "I am going to make 3 points about believing and disbelieving," he said, "and ask you some questions. Then I will tell you what we'll do. First of all, let me say this much. You are one of the best priests I have ever had anything to do with, and I have been around priests for decades, as you must know. I want to say that much straight off, before you allow yourself any foaming martyr notions about resigning. Second, do not tell anyone about this crisis of faith, as you call it. I will always be where you can find me, at the diocese or on one of my various visits around the state. You can say whatever you like to me, but keep your mouth shut to others. For one thing, what you are experiencing, which you called a crisis of faith, isn't a crisis at all. It's a simple loss. It is only your loss, not God's. We can probably fix it. First, we have to get clear, for starters. I don't know when this loss came on. Did you ever have faith, Eliza?" Eliza mustered some dignity. "Well, it depends on what you mean by faith." The bishop said without malice, "It doesn't depend on 1 minute or anything like what someone means by faith. People with faith know they have it. People without it, usually, basically, know they haven't got it. They ease their feelings by pointing out how we need to define what we mean by such and such. Whenever people say we need to define what we mean by something, they are just gassing. Nathan Hale never defined what he meant by patriotism, as far as I know, and the British who hanged him never defined what they meant by rope. Besides, Eliza, why should anyone have faith? So much of Christian doctrine is preposterous, the way most doctrine of any religion I have ever read about is preposterous. But how can someone admit such a thing aloud? They'd lose their jobs. Unbelievers know they are unbelievers, but they still yearn for belief. So they invent bypass language, like depends on what you mean by faith." The old man fell silent. This was totally not going well, and it wasn't going to be quick either. Eliza's voice clattered like a bag of small stones. "I never believed either of the creeds, Bishop." He laid a hand on her hand, gave it a pat. "Thank you for not lying, Eliza," he said. "If you have never believed, then you have lied your way through seminary. If you can remember back to your confirmation, 3 years before college, did you lie your way through that?" "Yes," Eliza said. "Thank you again for not lying to me now," the bishop said. "You have lied through confirmation, through college, through seminary, and every day or so at St. Fursey. You've had this parish 3 years. Take out a 2-week holiday for each. 3 years gives us 150 Sundays of Apostles or the Nicene Creed. It's good to get exact. Eliza seethed. The bishop had to have known hundreds and hundreds of disbelieving parishioners out east, where, as any fool knew, to be Episcopalian had little to do with doctrine. Why beat up on one rural Midwest priest like herself? He couldn't have needled all those well-heeled New Englanders. This bishop's reputation had preceded him to Minnesota. A fine priest, a much-loved spiritual leader, as well as able administrator, etc., etc., etc. The diocesan Ragan of the time had said that young people in his care had learned to trust the things unseen. Other praise, not in print, but carefully looked into, and just as carefully leaked to the Diocese of Minnesota. The man hadn't left behind unpaid parish bills. He had not dumped mission churches into escrow. He had not arranged to steal failed parish buildings from whatever little towns they stood in and then liquefy them to beef up diocesan coffers. Now then, the bishop again, in a bracing change of tone, a question for you, Eliza. But Eliza was too upset to be afraid. She had already lost all. She was a confounded liar in the eyes of a leader whose mentorship had once touched her. The bishop said, "Now tell me carefully, have you told any other lies to members of this parish?" Eliza nearly shouted, "No!" She was fed up with feeling guilty. If the bishop only knew what kind of creeps made up this stable of priests, if he knew, he would get off her back. The bishop said, "Good, I didn't think you had. As I said, Eliza, you are one of the best priests I've known." "Oh, yes," she thought, "I forgot he said that. Still, counselors always say some favorable thing at the start." Eliza knew that old drill. The man was talking again. "So far as I can tell, you haven't lied for the sake of money, sex, or other self-interest. I think you are a serious rector. One more question. When is the last time you have prayed alone at your communion rail? Private prayer. Not service prayer done for the congregation." A moment of silence. In a relaxed, casual tone, the bishop said, "Have you ever come in here alone, Eliza, gone up to the rail and prayed?" "I have not." "All right," the bishop said, "we'll fix that. The still accepted theory is that the quality of a parish priest depends entirely on the quality of the priest's prayer life. A ridiculous idea. A good parish depends on any number of things. In a minute we will go up to your rail. I am going to pray for you." Kindness as clean as snow fell on her from this old man. Still, it was only snow on a hot wound. The feeling of it vanished as fast as it landed. She did not believe there was a God, and so the bishop praying for her at the altar was practically retro. Still, totally kind. Shaky kindness was following on her. The bishop said, "Now, the way you handle the problem of having no faith is to decide consciously what you can do inside yourself and what you cannot do inside yourself. In your case, though, since you do not believe in God," and the old man gave an abrupt wave of the hand, "you will have to stop admiring yourself for being so independent. Forget all the drivel about a higher power. Forget it. At the same time, don't blame people for making up fancy words for God, because look, Eliza, they don't pay you a fortune at St. Fursey, but they do pay you. In the United States, other people can lose their jobs, their pensions, their everything, if word gets out that they don't believe in God. Don't forget that. If you have some atheists in your parish, be tolerant with them. Think of how easily a police state, should we become one, could decide to frame anyone who said aloud anywhere that he or she was not just a liberal or a dissenter, but an atheist. They'd sting you dead before you heard the rattle of their tails." Eliza now said, "Bishop, I want to hear everything you are saying, but I am having trouble. I am in trouble just now. I'm sorry. I can't follow what you are saying anymore. I can't listen anymore. I can't think anymore." The old man lifted one of Eliza's hands, covered it with both of his own, as if to warm it. Then he laid it back. "Stick, Eliza," he said, "only one more point, if you can. Learn the knack of talking to God with parishioners overhearing you, rather than the knack of talking to parishioners with God doing the overhearing. Bear in mind that most people can't get a single idea through their heads, except by celebrating. Or maybe they never do learn anything. but the celebrating at least puts an eddy into the flow, cool flow of their practical lives. Have you ever seen lightning on a summer night over a solid waste dump? There was one at my last parish. One evening I was walking at the beginning of a storm. I got through some woods, and just as I came out to what had once been a dairyman's meadow, a huge general lightning flash showed me a whole scene of trash. Chunked cars, refrigerators, skids leaning in a pile, all of it lightened up in blue. I never saw such stunning lightning before. I was sorry that the lightning showed how hideous a human landscape is compared to natural landscape, but I was excited. That's the way church going is for a good many people. I think it's what people mean when they say they love the beauty of the service. The old man gave a gentle laugh. The chancel and rood screen of St. Firsty were surprisingly dark for the noon hour. They went up to the rail. The bishop said, "Don't make any of the responses, Eliza. I will do the whole thing. This time you get to just let yourself be prayed for. Don't double-think anything." Eliza was bored at first. The bishop started with two versicles in response that she hadn't heard since a total The crazy English canon had visited Seabury Western one Good Friday. He had dragged everyone through an arcane sarum service. Then the bishop eased over to an ordinary collect of the morning service. He skipped to the extra prayers at the back of 1928 and prayed for all sorts and conditions of men. He wound up with what Eliza and other young Episcopalians had called the labor union prayer. For all those whose toil is difficult or troublesome for them. By the time the bishop had finished those set prayers and parts of collects, Eliza had lost all desire to make any responses. But now, somehow, the bishop left her behind. She could hear the old man's voice, but it sounded like the receding voice of someone who has trotted ahead on a path while you are merely standing. Eliza paid attention again. The bishop was explaining to God that this Eliza was a sinner, just as he himself was a sinner. Okay, the usual modesty rhetoric thing. She made herself listen, though. The bishop told God that Eliza did not practice avarice and that her nature was surprisingly merciful. He reminded God that mercy was rare in people only 27 years old. He told God that Eliza had two bad habits. At this, Eliza shook herself. Lying, yes. What was the other, second one? The bishop told God that Eliza allowed herself to be afraid. She was too scared too much of the time. The bishop asked God to help Eliza recognize fear when it showed up and to say to herself, "Here we go again. I am afraid." And then to tie up the fear in a package. A package of some manageable size, say a brick-sized package on her desk. The fear might never move away. She might know that fear all the rest of her life, but it would not wildly banner and wreathe like northern lights across her mind. It would be contained in the little cage she had made for it. The bishop reminded God, "Please help me take care of her. Help me, Almighty God," he said. Then he said, "Almighty God, who does not require the death of a sinner, please help me." Now the bishop raced even further ahead. In a bizarre, unpleasant tone from deep in his throat, the bishop said, "Oh God, help me to keep seeing your holy joy because my country has disgraced itself with cruelty, and I can't hide from thinking about it. I am so afraid." At last he wound up in the conventional way, but still very fast, clearly to keep Eliza out of it. "This I ask in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Amen." The bishop got to his feet. Eliza stood. The bishop turned to her as if just reminded that she was there. He said in a jocular tone, "Someone has been desecrating your communion rail, Eliza, rubbing off smut on the other side. I'd have a word with your servers. It's usually the server, not ordinary parishioners, who do that. If you make the whole group of them wipe it clean with soapy water and rags and then dry it, it will do wonders for whichever of them is the wrong one. You can tell the group it is too revolting a job to wish off on the Fair Linen Guild, if you have one, or even on to the sexton. By the way, Eliza, if you haven't got a Fair Linen Guild, you might ask the women to form one. Good tough guild can do wonders. Of course, there's some risk. They will be either for you or against you. But either way, they will do some of your dirty work for you. If you tell them that an acolyte is rubbing off snot onto the underside of the communion rail, they will look at you as if you were vulgar for mentioning such things. Don't be deceived, Eliza. Within a week, they will have it all over the parish that a certain acolyte has been rubbing snot onto the rail, but our rector put a fast stop to that. Bishop himself was meanwhile wiping along the rail with a beautiful, gigantic, white, monogrammed handkerchief of his own. He showed Eliza the cupped handkerchief full of chewing gum wads, what looked like killed spiders and worse. "Your rail is really bad," he remarked in a companionable tone. "Also, if you have a sexton, you might mention someone left a dead mouse on top of the entrance sign-up table." Eliza opened her mouth to laugh with him, but no sound came out. She opened her mouth again, this time to thank him. Again no sound came out. The bishop waited a moment, then shook hands and said, "I'll tell you something, Eliza. Only people who have some sort of good inside them are ever struck dumb by prayer. Struck dumb, like you. Get that through your head." He practically trotted back down the aisle. Eliza hustled after him. At the door, the bishop shook hands again, then turned his back and was fleet as a kid escaping, getting out to his natty little Jetta. Eliza watched from the lynch gate, meaning to feel lightly amused and affectionate, but she was not amused or affectionate, and the bishop, for all his doctrine that she didn't believe in, was not just a nice old fellow. He was a lot more complex a person than she was. Most of her acquaintance were less complicated than she was. Not this one. After a while, Eliza went to the vestibule closet, pulled out her down-filled jacket, heavy gloves, and visor cap with ear flaps. She drove east and then north along the highway. She tried to recite her plan aloud to herself in the car. Her voice had not come back yet. Go see Katie's treehouse. If Katie still needed help raising her 2x6s for the ridgepoles or rafter, if she was having rafters, then Eliza could help. She parked on the shoulder above the road with its old signs still legible. Solid Waste Transfer Station. $700 fine for dumping outside the gates. The gate had been half open for years, ever since the station was abandoned. People and creatures made various uses of the place. The poor of St. Frizzy saved 33 a month on garbage pickup. They slipped into the fence opening and dumped. Lovers left contraceptive kits, several kinds, top drawer and bottom drawer, all around what had once been the main burning area. Fireweed had seeded itself out everywhere. Bears, skunks, deer, voles, and mice searched skillfully among the busted skids and furnace filters. Katie Anderson and a couple of her tomboy friends had got up the floor part of a treehouse onto a lower three-branch spread of an oak. Eliza saw the girl's bike getting furred with snow. Katie herself sat quietly upon her platform. She had left her ladder hanging. When she saw Eliza, she put a finger to her lips with one hand and singled her up the ladder with the other. Eliza went up. Katie must have been holding still for a long time, her shoulders and cap covered with undisturbed snow as they were. Eliza looked where the girl now pointed. She made out a huge, dark, liquidly moving bear on the other side of the center junk. The mother was eating. A black cub stood beside her with its delicate nose moving about. Eliza raised a joyful fist to Katie, and Katie made a fist back. Back of them, a car drove up and stopped behind Eliza's car on the highway shoulder. It was hard to hear its quiet engine in all that snow, but the baby bear rose up onto its back legs. Eliza and Katie turned around. A man carrying a 12-gauge descended gingerly from the highway shoulder and let himself pad along into the enclosure. He raised his gun. He was leaning his cheek to the stock where he would brace his point in the time-honored, concentrated way. He looked to be less than 40 yards from the bears. Eliza left off the treehouse platform and began shouting, "No, no, absolutely no." Then she ran, waving her arms, still shouting, keeping a slant course toward the bears, so the shooter would startle and be put off his point. The Episcopal priest died nearly immediately. She did not learn that she had been accidentally killed by the wife battering husband of her cleaning woman. She did not learn that her body itself was what had spoiled his shot, and that both of the wild animals, mother and cub, had streamed back safe into the whitened forest. Also, she did not learn that her server, a 14-year-old kid, leapt up at the supper given after the requiem in a voice coarsened by tears, had shouted, "I always thought our rector was just some kind of a chicken fool, but turns out I was wrong."
You've been listening to episode 14 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half.